Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The last election was about the cost of living. Part of voter dissatisfaction was based on inflation and the rising cost of everyday staples. But there was also the gnawing realization that the American dream has become unattainable for many. The promise that if you work hard, success and a comfortable life will follow no longer rings true because it is no longer true. Today, working hard doesn't even guarantee many people a place to live. Wages for an increasing number of hardworking people no longer provide enough income to buy a house and pay the mortgage or even to pay for rent. The result has been a rising number of people who qualify as the working homeless, people who go to work every day but come home to, well, they don't have a home to come home to. They live in their cars, in shelters, or on the streets. They are the people who have realized there is no place for us, and that is the title of journalist Brian Goldstone's new book, which examines the lives of five families struggling to remain housed as the city of Atlanta gentrifies and prices residents out, even as they work multiple jobs to make ends meet. Dr. Goldstone joins us to fill us in this hour with Liz Clayson Kelly, CEO of Roof Above. That's a local organization dedicated to ending homelessness. And thank you both for being here. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Both of our guests today will be talking about Brian Goldstone's book tonight at 6 at Myers Park Presbyterian with a book signing to follow. You can go and be part of that if you'd like to tonight. Brian, let me start with you, because the rising number of working homeless is a national problem. We are experiencing it here in Charlotte, and yet your book centers on Atlanta. Is it centering on Atlanta because that is where you live, because the problem is worse there, or is Atlanta typical of what's going on around the country?
Yeah. So, I mean, part of the reason the book is based in Atlanta is just for practical reasons, because I do live there with my family. And in order to follow the five families in this book over a period of about 2 years in the book itself, but the reporting actually lasted longer than that, I knew I would need to, you know, be immersed in their lives. And in order to do that, it helped to be in the city where I live. But there's a more important reason the book is based there, and that's because of how representative Atlanta has become in this country. A lot of the coverage of the housing and homelessness crisis, both on the part of journalists and in the scholarly literature, it tends to be focused in kind of the predictable coastal cities like New York, LA, San Francisco. And it's not that what's happening in cities like Atlanta or Charlotte or Nashville or Austin or any number of other kind of mid-size up-and-coming cities is an aberration from what's happening in New York or San Francisco or in LA. It's that those latter cities, those bigger cities, are kind of a more extreme version, I would argue, of what cities like Atlanta are on their way to becoming. And we see the same trend everywhere. We see kind of the revitalization of urban space. We see the transformation of the city center. We see property values skyrocketing. And we see poor and working class people not just being pushed out of the neighborhoods they grew up in, but increasingly out of stable housing altogether. And that's a trend that I think is happening nationwide. And in that sense, the title of the book, There Is No Place For Us, it comes from one of the families in the book. That's not just an Atlanta title. That's a Charlotte title. That's a Chicago title. That's a New York and Nashville title.
Well, to make that point, you say that today in 2025, quote, there isn't a single state, metropolitan area, or county in the United States where a full-time worker earning the local minimum wage can afford a two-bedroom apartment. That is unfortunate at best, scandalous at worst. How long has this been the case?
It's definitely been the case for about the last decade or so, and it's just been getting worse and worse. Often when I talk about this issue across the country. If I give talks or even in the course of my reporting, I'll encounter people who say about the families I'm writing about, well, why don't they just move somewhere cheaper, move somewhere more affordable? Now, Atlanta, Metro Atlanta, was supposed to be that place that is more affordable. One of the main families in my book, they actually got priced out of their hometown of DC, out of their gentrifying neighborhood. And as a Black family, a Black couple, they wanted to seek economic opportunity in Atlanta. And Atlanta, the Black Mecca, was supposed to be that place where you could realize those aspirations. But, you know, more and more, there just is no place that is more affordable. Again, Charlotte, all of these cities were supposed to be places that you could go when you move from Chicago or LA or San Francisco or New York. And that phenomenon of just a growing chasm between what people are earning and what it costs to remain housed is it's getting bigger and bigger. And it's important to note that that a lot of, you know, cities have minimum wages that are higher than the federal minimum wage. But in those cities, the rents are exponentially higher. So that chasm exists regardless of what the minimum wage often is.
You mentioned a question that I've heard people ask, why don't they just move? Here's another question people ask. If only they would just get a job, why don't they get a job? Do they prefer to live on the street? Is there something wrong with these people? Why would they make that decision? And when you looked into this, you as you've just gone into, it's not that they want to be there. They have no other choices. They're working hard and still can't afford housing. Do you believe that most people, that most policymakers understand this?
Absolutely not. I mean, this is not necessarily a new phenomenon of people in the formal labor force who can't afford a place to live and are being pushed into homelessness as a result. When mass homelessness first exploded in the U.S. during the 1980s under the Reagan administration, this phenomenon was happening. The fastest growing segment of the homeless population at that time were children under the age of six, and they belonged to households who were part of the labor force. So the phenomenon of the working homeless is not necessarily new. But from the very beginning, there has been an attempt, a very concerted attempt that I document in the book, to obscure the root causes of homelessness, to make it seem like people are becoming homeless because of these kinds of individual pathologies, addiction, you know, maladies like mental illness. And from the very beginning, that was not the major driver of homelessness. So if anything has changed about this phenomenon, it's just the scale that more and more and more people in this country are working and working and working some more, and it just isn't enough to secure housing. And policymakers, you know, to use the phrase working homeless is to be forced to confront some really fundamental myths about the American dream, that if you just work hard enough, you might not strike it rich, as you said in your opening, but you'll at least be able to secure this minimal stability. And so to talk about the working homeless is to talk about the ways that that promise has not been fulfilled. And I think there's a reason why policymakers choose to ignore it, because it's easier to focus on individual problems and blame it on, make it homelessness, as one scholar put it in the 90s, a problem of persons rather than a problem of policy.
That's Dr. Brian Goldstone. He's a journalist and the author of the book, There Is No Place for Us, Working and Homeless in America. We're also here with Liz Clayson-Kelly, the CEO of Roof Above. You've been on this program several times in the past talking about various aspects of this, and we'll get into the nitty-gritty and some of the detail later on. But just from a 30,000-foot view, Liz, over the time that you've been at Roof Above, have things, with regard to what we're talking about this morning, gotten worse, stayed the same, gotten better?
Yeah. Sadly, I have been doing this work more than two decades now. And if we measure that a couple different ways, so one is just the scale of the problem. So despite all of our work to create more services and create specialized housing solutions, we have seen homelessness increase. I think where I see the impact the most, we track when people leave homelessness behind, what type of housing interventions do they go to? And if we look at that data from 10 or more years ago, you really see our marketplace being a big part of housing solutions. So, you know, just the way the market works. Older apartments were renting maybe for, you know, $600, $650, $700. In the last decade, we've seen those market solutions go away. We are growing, we're prospering. And as part of that, we attract capital investments from really around the world. So these older apartments are being bought and rents are being raised, and we're dealing with the realities at the front door of roof above of that changing housing market.
It is often said that Charlotte is about 5 years behind Atlanta on some of these trends that we're talking about today. I'm just curious where you think we are today in comparison to what Brian writes about in his book. Are you seeing the same things, some of the same things? Are you seeing a trend line that would point us in the direction that he writes about where Atlanta is today?
I do think that general thought holds true for housing. That's why we brought Brian here, because we think this book is really a great representation of what we're trending towards here in Charlotte. You know, one of the things Brian writes about is this powerful public investment that has done wonderful things for Atlanta, the Beltline. But we also see in Atlanta how that has impacted the housing market. I think about wonderful steps forward in Charlotte, like our greenways and our light rail. But the reality is, if we are not intentional about creating affordable housing, the market will utilize those interventions and will use them to further the chasm between the haves and have-nots.
I'm not sure how things are in the state of Georgia or in the city of Atlanta, which is their capital city, but our capital city is Raleigh. They don't like us very much, Brian, here in Charlotte. We are the great state of Mecklenburg, and there are very few tools in a local policymaker's toolbox that they can use here to incentivize or even require builders and developers to include workforce housing in their new projects. Is Atlanta different? Do they have those tools?
The city of Atlanta has tried to implement certain measures like what's called inclusionary zoning to make sure that new developments going up near the Beltline, which Liz referenced a moment ago, the Beltline is sort of the ultimate signifier of the new Atlanta. It's a 22-mile mixed-use trail that kind of circles the perimeter of the city, and everything the Beltline touches from one perspective turns to gold, and from another perspective is sort of a curse, because if you have the misfortune of being poor or working class and living near the Beltline, chances are you're going to get priced out of that neighborhood. So policymakers in the city have tried to mandate things like inclusionary zoning to make sure that a certain number of units in new apartment complexes are set aside, just a kind of, you know, a few units are set aside in that development for people earning under a certain income. But, you know, I think the reason, I mean, and I don't want to minimize the importance of those kinds of measures. We basically need everything on the table right now. We need a both and approach. But something I try to suggest in the book, and I think this is borne out through the reporting, is that unless there's just a fundamental kind of paradigm shift in how we think about housing in the American city, we will continue to just sort of nibble around the edges at best of this crisis. We need to really be asking, what kinds of cities are we creating for ourselves? Who are our cities for? And one of the really perverse dynamics that is documented in my book is how the very people powering the growth of our cities, like Charlotte and Atlanta, the very people whose labor is making this growth possible, are unable to live in them any longer.
Brian Goldstone's our guest. His book is called There Is No Place for Us, Working and Homeless in America. He focuses on five families. We'll hear some of their stories as we go through the hour. He's here with Liz Clayson Kelly from Roof Above, and we're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Brian Goldstone is our guest, journalist, author of There Is No Place for Us, Working and Homeless in America, and Liz Clayson Kelly, CEO of Roof Above, an organization that's been working for years to try to find alternatives to homelessness. Both will be talking about his book tonight at 6 at Myers Park Presbyterian Church. Brian, you've been based in Atlanta for about, I think, 9 years now. Your wife is a nurse practitioner who you say was stunned, those are your words, while working there, by the number of patients who are working but who are homeless. And you focus on the stories of five real families in Atlanta. How did you find them? Why did you choose them? How typical are they and their stories to other people who work every day, sometimes two or more jobs, and still can't afford rent?
Yeah, so my wife, she was working at a community health center in Atlanta called Mercy Care, and she was seeing this trend of all these patients who were working at Walmart, driving for Uber and Lyft, working at McDonald's, working for Amazon, and when they finished their shifts, they were going not to an apartment, but living in their cars or in shelters or in these squalid extended stay hotel rooms. And maybe we can return to sort of the world of extended stay hotels because it's a really important phenomenon. But she was stunned by that. And when she told me about it, I was stunned. And I ended up writing a magazine article for the New Republic. I reported it over a period of about 7 months following one family in Atlanta. The mom was a full-time home health aide. And by the time I met them, her and her children had been homeless for about 4 months. I began to wonder, is this some anomaly? Is this like an aberration? Why is this happening? Is it pervasive? And if it is pervasive, how is it pervasive? And so I continued to report, and it led me to this book where I realized after that initial reporting, I had only scratched the surface of this crisis. And so the book, the five families I met in the book, some of them I met as a result of that initial reporting by just hanging out around food pantries or following this one family to meetings with caseworkers or to churches. And I began to sort of embed myself at this extended stay hotel called Efficiency Lodge, and there were dozens of families living there. And so the problem in my case was not so much how do I find a family who fits this description, it's how do I narrow it down to a handful of families when it truly is such a growing phenomenon.
Liz, Brian writes that it is in the nation's richest, most rapidly developing cities, the ones doing well, that the threat of homelessness has become particularly acute. By all measures, Charlotte is one of those cities that is really doing well. So how widespread is the problem here? And do we really know?
Yeah, so I can tell you, for example, at Roof Above, at our, you know, we operate emergency shelters, and we see about half of the people we serve when they come into the shelter. So day one in our shelter, about half of them have some kind of income that's split between working and fixed income. We're seeing more seniors and more folks on disability income. And so that's half of the people who have income. It's just not sufficient to find housing in our community. And I think
Brian,
that's pretty, yeah.
In those cities experiencing the greatest success, you write the delivery drivers, daycare workers, supermarket cashiers, and home health aides who help sustain our cities are being relentlessly priced out of them and often out of housing altogether. You call it an emergency born less of poverty than prosperity. Families are not falling into homelessness, you say. They are being pushed. Is there a place to lay the blame for this, or is this just capitalism and the fact that the poor have always been with us?
Yeah, I definitely think that it is the result of concrete policies. This isn't just kind of an organic development. That's why I resist the language of all these families and individuals falling into homelessness as if they just kind of tripped into the situation or it was just an accident of fate. I think it's important to note that the revitalization of our cities, the gentrification that is pushing people out of housing and out of their neighborhoods, is planned. Before an area can become gentrified, it first has to become gentrifiable. And that happens at the level of urban planning, urban policy, and its sort of confluence with real estate capital. And, you know, that those are forces. Maybe some listeners have read the book The Power Broker by Robert Caro about the remaking of New York City through urban renewal. Those were very planned processes. And sometimes when we just see a neighborhood being transformed, we see new coffee shops coming in or yoga studios, it can feel like that just kind of happened, you know, through the invisible hand waving a magic wand over a neighborhood. But these are actually planned processes. And, you know, I think the most shocking revelation that I came upon in this reporting is that homelessness, you know, is not emerging now. It's not skyrocketing in the places that are the poorest in America. It's happening in the richest areas, the most rapidly developing urban centers. And in that sense, it's not just a matter of this cliche of, you know, extreme wealth coexisting alongside this extreme deprivation. There's a causal relationship. The deprivation is actually being caused by the very boom of our cities.
And Liz, you have said that it is that revelation that makes you appreciate this book, that it demonstrates the shadow of the shadow side to our prosperity, something that you are obviously familiar with through the work that you do. Is this something you think most people realize? If people don't struggle, are they seeing the evidence of this, or do they understand the evidence of this?
I think what we're seeing across the country and in our community is as people move and work to participate in the housing market, they're feeling it themselves. You know, in your previous question, you mentioned poverty, and certainly people who are poor are not able to afford housing in our community. But we're increasingly seeing households that are middle income not really being able to participate in the housing market, or at least not in the ways they want to. One of the data points is if you are paying more than 30% of your income on rent, you're considered cost burden. And today, more than 60% of renters earning between $50,000 and $75,000, more than 60% are cost burden, meaning they're paying more than 30% of their income on rent. So I think people don't always connect it to homelessness, but I think most people who are middle income and less in our community are finding it difficult to participate in our housing market.
Because we are told, and I think because it used to be true, that if you worked hard, you could afford a decent middle class living, that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. I'm curious about the people you work with, Liz. How many of them ever thought that they would ever be in a position to need you? To be homeless, to not be able to afford a roof over their heads. And when it happened to them, did it just creep up on them? They obviously didn't fall into it, as Brian says. Were they pushed? Did they feel pushed? What were the forces that made them move in that direction?
So, and maybe this is a good time to talk about something Brian mentioned earlier, which is this whole extended stay motel phenomenon. Okay. But honestly, and you see this in Brian's book and a similar book called Evicted, that homeless service providers are often not the first place people go, but they're often the last place people go. So people have stayed on couches with friends and family. They've been in hotels. So by the time people end up in our doors, very often their sense of self has been transformed. So Mike, as you say, it's like no one imagines for themselves that, you know, that they're going to end up in a shelter. And so we have a lot of conversations that remind people, you know, this isn't permanent. This isn't who you are. We don't say homeless people. We say people experiencing homelessness, because it really is just an indication of your housing status. It's not an indication of your worth.
Talk to me a minute about these extended stay hotels, because it's, you know, hotels are not cheap. And so, quite often, many, many, many people in a family are living in a single hotel room with a bathroom and a sink and maybe two beds and a TV. How if you're homeless, if you can't afford rent, how can you afford that? Brian.
Yeah, so a lot of people who are living in these extended stay hotels are not necessarily there because they couldn't afford rent. The families in my book who end up in these places, they often became homeless, or to use that language again, were pushed into homelessness by a lack of tenant protections in states like Georgia and North Carolina. So in one family's case, their hot water heater was broken, not for days or weeks, but for months. And the mother refused to pay her rent until the landlord fixed the hot water heater. When she appeared before the judge said, "Did you pay your rent?" And she said, "No, ma'am." And she and her children lost their home. So it wasn't necessarily not being able to afford the rent, although that is certainly an issue. But, you know, at that point, once you lose your home, you have the choice of either going to a family shelter, which in DeKalb County, where I live, there is not a single family shelter right now where families can go. So you're either on the street or you're in one of these hotels. And these hotels are not, you know, a Residence Inn or Homewood Studios where business travelers would stay. These are at the opposite end of the spectrum. Conditions there are uniformly abysmal. And the rents that people are forced to pay, again, not, I mean, for years, families are trapped in these hotels. One family in the book, the one that moved from DC, they ended up at Extended Stay America, and in a span of 8 months, paid $17,000. That's more than double what they were paying at their apartment. But because their credit had been tanked, and this three-digit number had come to determine whether they could get into housing again, they were trapped in this expensive prison, as they called it. So this model is an entire world of homelessness that we're not seeing that dwarfs the official number of homeless people in this country, and it's extremely profitable. These hotels are being bought up by private equity firms like Blackstone and Starwood Capital because they are seeing how lucrative this insecurity has become.
As I read through the stories of the five folks that you profile in your book, and maybe I got the wrong impression, I don't know, but my impression is that the laws in Georgia are stacked against these people. You write about Britt, who was waiting on a Section 8 housing voucher, which allows renters to pay no more than 30% of their income on rent, and the federal government takes up the slack. But the Section 8 program, you say, is woefully underfunded, which has left millions of people on waiting lists. You write about Celeste's, whose home was destroyed, as I understand, her rental home was destroyed by fire. Worse, she had received an eviction notice tacked on the door of the burnt-out house that she was living in, and because she didn't visit the burnt-out house she was living in a sufficient amount of time, she was evicted, and that eviction goes on her record, which makes it very difficult, if not impossible, for her to get alternative housing because she has been evicted. You write about Kara, who you just referred to. After a month without hot water, she called lawyers. She called local media for help. Nobody followed up. And Georgia, being among the most landlord-friendly states in the country, has no law preventing landlords from evicting tenants for reporting hazardous conditions. Retaliatory evictions, you say, are not prohibited, so tenants have the option of living in substandard, dangerous conditions or in a shelter or on the streets. Is this unique, or how unique is this to Georgia?
I mean, some of these lack of basic protections are somewhat unique to Georgia. I mean, Georgia is definitely an extreme example. There are many states like Georgia, but I think the general principle here is that there is a radical power imbalance between landlords and tenants in this country. And you know, there's a desire on the part of some to just say, to solve the housing crisis, to solve the homelessness crisis, we just need to build more housing units. And there is some truth to that, but what that leaves unaddressed is this power imbalance. And it's the power imbalance that will see a kind of relentless churn of people continuing to become homeless, even if you're able to get certain people out of homelessness. And that's the case in many states. So, you know, what we have to do is keep people in the homes they already have. And how you do that is by strengthening tenant protections. It's not just even about the chasm between incomes and rents. It's really about how can people remain housed in the homes they have and make those homes safe and habitable and make sure that, you know, families, if they have a legitimate grievance, those grievances are addressed and they don't end up losing their home as these families did.
Liz, could some of these same stories be told through the people you work with? In other words, is the deck stacked against tenants in North Carolina or in Charlotte?
Well, I will tell you, there were definitely parts of the book that I read, particularly as it relates to responses during the COVID pandemic, that made me very grateful for the work that had been done in North Carolina to have some more tenant protections than what Brian was writing about. But I do think Brian makes an excellent point. And I love what he's saying around it's a both and approach, right? So it's how are we creating more housing? How are we protecting people and being more thoughtful around evictions? You know, during the pandemic, we saw, you know, there was a lot of interventions to reduce evictions, and that's really been different post pandemic. And so, you know, what are all of these different approaches? I love what's happening here in Charlotte with the Housing Impact Fund, where we're working to preserve older apartments and make them affordable at a variety of income ranges. And so I think we need to be looking at multiple ways to respond to this crisis, which isn't just impacting people who are poor, but it's impacting people across income spectrums.
Alleviating or reducing the number of homeless seems to be a goal of a lot of elected officials, particularly the mayor of Charlotte in this city. And we know that we have passed a series of $50 million bonds to help homeless alleviate the homeless situation, Liz, and we keep passing more. But it seems to be like whack-a-mole. We just can't keep up with the problem. Are these bonds that we have been saying yes to over and over and over again, and the money they provide for this problem, are they having a positive impact?
So you've got to keep in mind every single day I've worked on the front lines with people. So anytime we're creating housing solutions that we get to see people move into, we think that's a good thing. So please continue to support housing bonds. If you're asking, is this $50 million sufficient to address what's happening in our housing market? It's not. We are really, when you look at kind of outside investment, buying older apartments, what's getting lost every day, I always say at best, we're just slowing, you know, the hole that's getting bigger. These things are slowing it, and that's worth it. Again, I work with individuals. And so anytime you get to connect someone with housing, that has a transformative impact in their life. And you see that in Brian's book, when some people do reach moments of stability, but it's not sufficient for what our issues are. There's someone in town who said, we have mouse-sized solutions for an elephant-sized problem. Mm-hmm.
Liz Clayson-Kelly is CEO of Roof Above, an organization that works diligently to help people who find themselves homeless to get themselves out of it. Dr. Brian Goldstone is the author of There Is No Place for Us, Working and Homeless in America, which profiles the situation of five people in Atlanta struggling with homelessness. These are the working poor, people who go to work every day and yet still can't afford to place a place to live. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Our New South. This Charlotte-based Levine Museum podcast explores today's South through social, political, and cultural topics in their historical context, featuring conversations with locals driving change. Our New South is available on all podcast platforms.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the real picture of homelessness, the working poor, people who work sometimes more than one job and still can't afford a place to live. Five of them are profiled in our guest today, Dr. Brian Goldstone's book, There Is No Place for Us, Working and Homeless in America. He joins us along with Liz Clayson-Kelly, CEO of A Roof Above. Together, tonight, they will be taking a deeper dive into his book at 6 o'clock at the Myers Park Presbyterian Church, and you're invited to be part of that. All of us, Brian, have seen the homeless. We see them on the streets. We see them on television. We've done programs following the yearly federal government homeless count on this program every year in Charlotte. But you say we're not getting the full picture, that much of the reality of homelessness is being hidden from sight. Talk about that.
Yeah, I was shocked to discover that, again, there's this whole world of homelessness that is not just invisible, but really has been rendered invisible. This invisibility has been actively created and produced. And, you know, I was stunned to find that these extended stay hotels housed, or housed is not the right word, they temporarily sheltered tens of thousands of families just in Metro Atlanta alone. And these kinds of places are proliferating across the country. So none of the families who I profile in this book would actually be counted in that federal homeless census that takes place every year. They have been, they literally don't count. And the consequences of that not counting is not just that we don't have the full picture of homelessness in America and that we misdiagnose its causes because we don't see the experiences of families like this, but we also, but these families are also being locked out of crucial assistance and resources that are available to people who are designated homeless. And so really the only thing worse than not than being homeless in America is what these families experience, which is not even counting as homeless and therefore really being invisible from sight and ignored by policymakers and being locked out of crucial resources.
Why don't we count them? Is it deliberate or is it an oversight?
Yeah, I mean, again, it sort of goes back to the 1980s, when mass homelessness first emerged, there was a very concerted attempt to limit the scope of the problem. The more the scope is narrowed, the easier it is to say that the problem is being tackled. So if you limit homelessness just to what you see on the street or people in shelters, it is easier to, the problem feels a little bit more manageable. And also because a lot of the people who are suffering most visibly on the streets, you know, do tend to be suffering from substance use issues or mental health issues, it's easier to sort of blame homelessness on those things. So part of it is very deliberate. You know, there's also an attempt on the, a very well-meaning attempt on the part of advocates to parcel out scarce resources to those who, in their view, are most likely to, for instance, just die on the streets, who are most at most immediate risk of bodily harm and disability, and who are also the largest sort of burden on our systems and cost a lot of money. So there has been an attempt to sort of target resources at those who are deemed most vulnerable. But, you know, what we're doing in that process is ignoring all of the children who are exposed to toxic stress, which is what public health researchers call the conditions that result from being in these hotels, being in your car with your parents. There is an entire world of vulnerability that we're just missing. And it has really, really tragic consequences for millions of families in this country.
You write that in Atlanta, the city suffered for years from poor in the core, which arose because of deliberate disinvestment and the flight of white residents to surrounding suburbs to draw, to the surrounding suburbs. And the same thing has happened in almost every city in the country, including Charlotte. But the arrival of the Olympics in Atlanta in 1996 coincided with a concerted campaign to draw a more affluent demographic to the city proper. Same thing is happening here without the Olympics. Tax incentives, you write, and other public subsidies were mobilized to entice developers and real estate capital to build and invest within the city limits. That has changed the core into something beyond recognition. You say shinier, trendier, and much wealthier. Charlotte, same thing. As less affluent Atlantans were pushed out of those areas, did policymakers make any concessions for them? Was there any concern about what would happen to them as these new shiny buildings went up in Atlanta and more affluent people moved in?
I think there were at times attempts to sort of give lip service to this predicament when it was acknowledged at all. But by and large, the focus has been on continuing to make our city and many cities across this country just wealthier and to induce more growth. And, you know, a lot of policymakers in our cities are still stuck in this mindset, like that, you know, capital and investment is still flocking to the suburbs, still flocking outside of the city center. And so they're using public funds to, you know, entice more investment in the city. I think that if there is talk of protecting what in Atlanta are often called legacy residents, you know, families who have lived in the city who are often working class for decades, it's not backed up by concrete policy. And the proof is in the pudding. The proof is in the fact that the city continues to experience really unimpeded growth. Unemployment is at a historic low, and yet the workers powering the city can no longer afford to live in it, and again can't even afford in many cases a place to live. So I'm less interested in what policymakers and city leaders are saying than in what reality actually looks like on the ground.
Liz, over the course of the many years that I have done this program, we've done a number of programs on smart growth and new urbanism and how it applies to Charlotte and what good things could come from that approach. And Brian writes about what it did in Atlanta, but he writes between 2010 and 2023, median rents soared by 76%. The metro area lost 60,000 apartments renting for $1,250 or less, with 94% of the tens of thousands of apartments added to the city's rental market being, quote, luxury units, unquote. And he mentions that many of the businesses that sprang up to service these new residents, some of which he's talked about already, these yoga studios and craft breweries, same thing we're experiencing here, is where somebody's affordable housing complex was torn down to make way for those businesses. How similar is our story, Liz, particularly when you look at some of the areas being gentrified here?
Yeah, well, I will say I grew up in East Tennessee, so I love living in a prosperous city. So I'm not knocking. I love that we're growing. I do just think we have to be intentional and more thoughtful because the reality is, if we are not intentional about making housing solutions at affordable rents, across for middle income Charlottians as well as low income Charlottians, that in the end doesn't just impact a small group of people experiencing poverty, that impacts the overall well-being of our community. And that's where I look to things like the Housing Impact Fund. I mean, you so noted that Raleigh doesn't give us as many public policy tools as other cities might have. And we found creative ways to work to begin to address some of this by trying to preserve older apartments. And I think now is the time that we double down on those efforts.
I want to go back to something you talked about earlier, Brian, and that is the fact that there is money to be made from the working poor who find themselves unable to afford a lot of housing, and those who are just on the cusp of not being able to afford it. Because you talk about these developers who are coming in, or investors who are coming in and buying up great swaths of homes to make them rental units or affordable housing apartments that are being bought up, and they raise the rents. This is capitalism, pure and simple, but these are private equity firms, and they buy these places just to jack up the rent and make more money. Is there something that can be or should be done about that?
Yeah, I mean, I know I keep using the word shocked and stunned, but again, in the course of this reporting, I really was astonished to find how at every turn in these families' journeys, these five different families, there were entire business models designed to capitalize on their insecurity, to really squeeze as much revenue, as much profit as possible from their desperation. And one of the most striking examples of that, again, is that, like you say, private equity firms, Wall Street investors are, there's been an incursion of those actors into the rental market in cities like Atlanta. And what I found was that they're not only cornering the market on the housing that people need to live in, but they're also cornering the market on the places where these families are pushed into, like these extended stay hotels, where they're forced to go. And these hotels, again, are like extremely profitable homeless shelters. They're de facto homeless shelters. And I just think, my background is in anthropology. And for me as an anthropologist, what I'm hoping to induce in readers is a sense of how is it that something as fundamental as housing, as a place to live, a roof overhead, has become this immense source of profit for some in this country. Imagine if we treated education that way, public education, that whoever was lucky enough to afford a private school could be educated and anyone else was sort of left to fend for themselves. That's what we've done with housing. We've allowed this precious resource to be hoarded and sort of auctioned off to the highest bidder. And I hope that in following these family stories, readers, you know, will feel what that is like for a parent, for their children, when this most basic human necessity is constantly out of reach, and they'll begin to wonder, how can we have a different approach to housing in this country?
The working homeless are not homeless out of choice. It is because of circumstances that we've all talked about and low wages that are not keeping pace with inflation and the cost of housing. But these people are on the street not because they like it or because they're too lazy to get a job. On the contrary, and despite the fact that this isn't their fault, I'm curious, is there shame attached to it? And if so, why? This didn't happen because of anything they did or didn't do. Brian.
Yeah, you know, despite documenting all of the forces, all of these external factors militating against these family stability, it was heartbreaking to see how the parents internalized the judgment that is directed at a parent who can't provide housing for their children. You know, the shame that is really intense. And I think that the shame should actually be on, it should be us who experience the shame. Those who are
That's
better.
That's what I was going to ask you. Should the shame be on the people who can't afford the housing because they don't make enough money, or should it be on the employers who won't pay more than minimum wage and the minimum wage isn't enough to live on?
Absolutely. It should be on the better off residents of our cities, on us who have allowed this crisis to perpetuate and who have told ourselves the comforting story that if people are on the street, if they are in these hotels, if they are in shelters, it must be because of something they've done. The shame, I think, is too much for us to bear. If we look at the reality, we will have to confront the fact that both terms in that phrase, working homeless, the work side and the housing side, have been an utter failure. And it would be, I think the shame is too much for us to bear. And so we make up these other stories and direct the blame and the shame elsewhere.
Liz, the Trump administration is fundamentally changing the world economy. Even as we speak, the federal government has cut basic funding that has driven America's success in science and research, while also defunding programs that have helped the less fortunate here and around the globe. And as you look at what is being done in Washington, what are your biggest worries about how these changes may or are altering the prospects of the least fortunate among us? And I ask this question as the stock markets around the world are crashing around us because of these unnecessary tariffs.
Yes, we are as roof above and what I would say a place of uncertainty. There's kind of what levels the programs we depend upon might be funded, what levels they'll be funded at. But more importantly, there's questions about what will be in our government contracts, what rules will be attached. If you read Project 2025, they pretty clearly state their desire to end what's called a housing first approach, which is an approach that has in the past had bipartisan support, and it refers to really lowering barriers to get people quickly connected with housing and surrounding them with supports.
Why did they want to end that?
Yes, that is not clear to me because there's great research behind the effectiveness. I think it goes back actually to some of this shame and stigma question that you just asked, because part of the barriers that are lowered are you're not required to take mental health medication, you're not required to be sober before moving in. I meet people from a wide variety of economic spectrums, and I will tell you substance use is something that does not discriminate against your income level. It's just better hidden in places of wealth.
And from your experience, is the substance abuse problem that many of these people suffer from, does that result in their homelessness, or is it the result of their housing insecurity?
So I've seen both, and I think Brian's book does a great job. You see a couple of the families that he follows, you see substance use begin to become a problem as a coping mechanism to deal with all of the trauma that they're confronting. And that's certainly something that we see every day in our work.
Brian, I only have a minute left, but who did you write this book for? Who do you hope reads it, and what do you hope comes from your efforts? Because this was not an easy book to write.
It wasn't an easy book to write or report. And, you know, I think at one time I would have answered that question. I wrote this book for policymakers. I wrote this book for people in positions of power. But now I would say I wrote it for everyone else. I wrote it for ordinary residents in our cities to read this and see what people all around them are experiencing, the travesty, the injustice of lacking this most basic human necessity, really being deprived of it. And I hope that people will read this and be shocked and be outraged and say, no more, this is intolerable.
And the problems that you write about, they are fixable very quickly, yes or no?
Oh, they are utterly fixable and they are utterly preventable. And we just need the political will to see it through.
Brian Goldstone is the author of There Is No Place for Us, Working and Homeless in America. And Liz Clayson Kelly is the CEO of Roof Above. Thank you both for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.